everyone. It's Sandy Cruz from Sandy K Nutrition, health and lifestyle queen. And I'm here to show you that balanced living works. This is especially for all you ladies over 40. We will cover a range of exciting topics with many special guests, and I really look forward to this season. Bye for now. Hi, everyone. Welcome to Sandy K Nutrition, health and lifestyle queen. Today, I am going to release part two of my two-part podcast webinar with Dr. Bill Lawrence. This one is going to be all about DNA methylation and his study relating to DNA methylation. He's got two studies, remember. I released the one on telomeres and how they affect your biological age. And this one is DNA methylation and how it affects your biological age. And he's going to explain what all of it means and the studies that he is conducting right now. Okay. So, and in addition, as another piece to this, what is he using to help reduce his patients' biological age in these two areas? Now, these are two pretty major areas that determine how well we are aging. So what he is trying to do is show in his studies that using these particular peptide bioregulators out of Russia, he can reduce the biological age of his patients. Pretty cool stuff, you guys. Now, I'm going to preface this by saying none of this is medical advice. This is all for educational purposes only. I'm not going to talk any more about this because I'm going to let Dr. Bill Lawrence do all the talking in this podcast. I'm going to just tell you about a few things going on. If you want to watch and see the slides from some of his amazing presentations in Europe that he's done, then go to my YouTube channel. Make sure that you subscribe because I am publishing a lot of my podcast interviews on YouTube now. Not all of them, but a lot of them. So go there and subscribe. It's Sandy K Nutrition, like everywhere else. I'm on Twitter. I'm on TikTok. I'm on Instagram the most probably at Sandy K Nutrition. I'm on Facebook. I have a private women's Facebook group, Sandy K Nutrition, Health and Lifestyle Queen. I'm on Clubhouse, so I'm kind of everywhere, you guys. I'm also a registered holistic nutritionist. I do work with clients. I work with clients only. I do consults as well, but typically I work with clients for a 3-month period. And my focus is always with women over 40. So with this, I am going to cut on through to this interview because it is a little lengthy. Do feel free to subscribe, share, definitely review, because that means the world to us podcasters when we get reviews. And I would love to hear from you, Sandy at Sandy K Nutrition, if you want to get in touch with me. And for now, let's cut on through to Dr. Bill Lawrence, part two, DNA methylation. Hi, everyone. Welcome to Sandy K Nutrition, health and lifestyle queen. Today with me, I welcome back Dr. Bill Lawrence. We had Dr. Bill on, I'm calling you Dr. Bill. We had you on the show a while back and you talked to us all about this fabulous study on telomeres that you are actually conducting. So you're conducting two clinical studies and today we're going to talk a little bit more about the DNA methylation study, which is another study of aging. And I'm going to, for those of you who haven't watched the first one yet, I just want to make sure that I introduce Dr. Lawrence properly. He actually has a law degree. He has a Master of Science in Psychology and a PhD in Nutrition. Since 1990, his focus has been on slowing and reversing human biological aging.
He's developed numerous science-based protocols focused on optimal aging for health professionals and individual clients. And presently, he is the administrator of these two clinical studies, one of which we're going to discuss today. So welcome back, Dr. Lawrence.
Sandy, it's a pleasure to be here. Actually, as I always say, it's a pleasure to be any place.
Of course, of course. Don't we all feel this way these days? Yes. But yeah, I'm excited to get back into this topic because it's definitely near and dear to my own heart. I am 51. I'm not quite there yet, but I definitely want to be there where I am in my 70s and ballroom dancing like yourself and your partner, right?
Absolutely. We were out Friday, Saturday, and Sunday night.
That's amazing. You see, this is the kind of thing that I believe, you know, anybody who really cares. There's going to be people who don't care. That's just a fact. Some people just don't care and they just leave it to destiny, whatever maybe. But I'm personally not one of them, and I know a lot of people in my community are not those type of people either. So very interested in this type of information. So, you know, maybe we can start. I know that you brought your presentation with us, and maybe we can start at the beginning, like we did last time, for those of you who have seen the first video. I would suggest that you go back and watch, because Dr. Lawrence gets into great detail about the telomerase activation study first. And today it's going to be more of a review of that. And then we're going to get into the meat of the DNA methylation study, which is really part two of what Dr. Lawrence does. So if you'd like to take the stage, I would love that.
Okay, Sandy, context here for a second.
Yeah.
I have been heavily invested in health and longevity for a long time, more than three decades. And as I mentioned in the other podcast and YouTube, we don't have longevity in the male side of my family line. Everybody dies in their 50s and 60s, including my father. And that's what caused me to change careers and focus the last 30 years. And I didn't mention it before, and I oftentimes don't mention it, but I'm going to be 75 in a couple of months. I have 10 siblings, a large Mormon family, and already three of those siblings have died. Two of them when they reached 61, another one when she was 63, and then just a few months ago, a niece of one of the deceased died at age 40.
Oh my gosh.
So what drives me is the issue in our family, of course. You know, we don't have longevity. And I guess the other thing that drives me is just I love waking up to another day of whatever this life is going to be on out there. It's like the most amazing adventure for me. And, you know, even the tough days, you know, I can't say that in the moment of that tough day, I'm thinking, what a wonderful adventure. But when I look back at it later, having survived whatever that was, you know, even the misadventures, just to have life another day, another month, another year, is what drives me. And a lot of my research is about what the maximum lifespan of humans can be.
Mm-hmm.
And I slipped in a slide towards the end. There's a new study that came out that's basically suggesting 150 is within our grasp.
Wow.
Yeah.
And that's healthfully, right? That's health
yes.
span.
Yes, oh yes.
Not just
yes,
lifespan, yes. but health span.
Yes, absolutely. So with all that, I can go through a quick review of the studies in terms of who's involved in these studies, and then we'll talk about peptides quickly, and then we'll talk about, we'll get down to the DNA methylation.
Perfect.
So there are two clinical studies, and there's actually sort of two and a half, but there's two clinical studies. The first one, as Sandy, you've spoken about, the telomere study, is what I call a confirmation study. The Russians already figured out that they could use peptides. They figured this out in the 90s, that they could use peptides to activate the telomerase enzyme. And that telomerase enzyme then allows us to replace or regrow or lengthen the little end caps on the end of our chromosomes. And I won't spend a lot of time with it because people can look at the first video. But why that's important is that cell replication takes place as a result of our chromosomes splitting, forming, and so forth. And when those chromosomes split, they have to have an end cap to protect the integrity of the chromosome in order for the cell to actually duplicate or replicate itself perfectly. And each time the cells replicate, you lose a little bit of that end cap, as we talked about. Okay, so if you have something that can regrow those telomere end caps, then you get more cell replication. And I'll kind of leave it at there and let people take a look at the first video.
I do have one question. How many times in a lifetime do those cells replicate typically?
According to several scientists, about 50 to 60 times, okay?
Oh, okay.
Leonard Hayflick at the UC San Francisco back in the 60s did a long study and finally figured out that about 50 to 60 replications is what you can get for a human being. It's called the Hayflick limit. Very famous.
Yes, I've heard of that.
Yes. The Russians were able to exceed that. The Russian scientists were able to exceed that by 42%.
Wow, that's huge.
Yes, and the published paper. I sent the published paper to Dr. Hayflick about 3 years ago, but haven't heard back from him.
Hmm.
Anyway, so let's go through some of the background here.
Okay.
This is me pulling that the clock of time back, or at least attempting to do so with these two studies. As we talked about before, this is people's accepted paradigm for aging. This is what everybody expects. Okay. Not a very pretty picture, but that is what people expect. And at the moment, that more or less reality for most of us. Okay, there are lots of different theories of aging, more than shown on this slide. There's probably twice as many, maybe three times as many different theories. But the most powerful ones are shown here. That's the telomere shortening at the top up here. And then DNA damage, and I wouldn't call it DNA damage, but DNA methylation really is what it is. Things go wrong in the methylation process that we're going to talk about. Very powerful driver of aging. The one that's not up here, and the reason it's not up here is that scientists, pretty much any place other than Russia, don't have a intervention for it, is what we call organ regeneration. Now, when I say organ regeneration, people oftentimes think of, oh, yeah, surgeons can replace a finger now, okay,
right.
and those kinds of things, or can replace an ear and so forth. No, we're talking about all of the 78 human organs and systems can be regenerated, and that by itself will support extended lifespan, additional telomerase activation, Hayflick limits, and all that kind of stuff. We're going to talk about that towards the end of this presentation.
Okay.
So there's DNA methylation that we're going to talk about, and at the very end, organ regeneration. This is the group that I work with in St. Petersburg. They're Russian scientists, very bright, very smart people, very dedicated to using peptide bioregulators to both heal, cure, and extend life. This is my boss, Vladimir Kavinson, former military, extremely well known throughout Europe, hardly known here in the United States at all. As we talked about last time, it's really sad that there's not a lot of sharing of science and medical information between Russia and America, because these two are great countries, very, very advanced in both their science and medical, and they should be sharing, but unfortunately they don't very much. Okay, we'll skip through this stuff. I thought I had blacked these out. I'm sorry, they're showing up.
No, that's okay.
So this is my boss, Professor Cavinson, receiving Russia's highest civilian award for his 40-some-odd years of service, both in the military and then after the military in private practice to the Russian people. And this is basically, I call him his boss, basically his boss, Putin. I've never, as I said before, I've never seen President Putin at the St. Petersburg Institute, but his doctor is in there all the time.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, that's picking amazing. Up peptides and so forth. Okay, now, so peptides, and I'm going to define what they are in a moment, but they're basically, as Cavinson is saying here, they're signal molecules, okay? And they cause differentiation of cells, and they can be used to regenerate at the cellular level, therefore the tissue level, therefore the organ level. And we'll get into a little bit more. This is... Ivan Pavlov, people associate him with the classical conditioning with the dogs and so forth, but his work was human digestion, human physiology. And he was sort of the beginning of understanding both about protein digestion that then also associated itself later with peptide digestion. And this was in the early 1900s. He received the Nobel Prize for his work in 1904. So Cavinson in the military, it was the military that originally launched this investigation into peptides because, as I mentioned before, they were having all sorts of problems back in the 60s and the 70s, starting with the submarine corps. They would send these young seamen and the officers out on these 3 to 4 month voyages, and they would come back with all sorts of medical issues because part of it was that they were sitting next to nuclear reactors that were very crudely protected at that time. And so the military said, look, we can't have this kind of damage, particularly to the immune system, because these sailors were coming back with just destroyed thymuses at this point. So the Soviet military threw huge amounts of money at their medical corps, their science corps, to see if they could come up with a way of regenerating damaged organs and so forth. And Professor Cavinson, as I showed earlier, was the lead scientist at that time in that program. And they also then expanded it to the regular military. They expanded it to, it was part of the cosmonaut program. They were using peptides as the cosmonauts would come back from space. I couldn't bear to take that picture out. Sorry, Sandy. I love little Nisha, the space dog with
it's
that
okay.
cute little helmet.
I love dogs. I have two of them, so we're good with that.
Okay, good, good, good. Yeah. They use them at the Russian Olympic teams and so forth, mostly for recovery. That is, they have muscle peptides and various other peptides that are appropriate for Olympic athletes, who are under incredible strain and stress and so forth, and have all sorts of injuries as they're training for and competing. And so they use the peptides post-competition, typically post-training. Peptides, there's nothing magic about peptides. Peptides are basically just tiny proteins. If you take if you take less than 50 amino acids, and I think I have a picture here. Let me get here. Yeah, if you take a small group of amino acids and you string them together, we call them peptide bonds. You string them together, eventually they interface with the organs. They become proteins, basically. And because they're so small, they become able to pass through the digestive system pretty intact. They also can pass through cell membranes because they literally are so small. We're talking about three molecules, okay? They can pass through the blood-brain barrier, and so they get to the targeted area and they are able to then bind. So this is a pancreas peptide. It's three amino acids long, and it shows here how it binds into the DNA, okay? And it's very similar, as I spoke last time, it's here in the U.S. they call it armor thyroid medication.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I think the synthetic is called Synthroid, I believe.
Yes, I'm on it.
Okay.
Without a thyroid.
Yeah, and it's interesting, just kind of a sidebar, having dabbled with it a lot for the last 30 years with people and clients and so forth. It's interesting. Some people do really well on the natural armor that's derived from pigs.
Yes.
And some people don't, yeah, but they do really well on Synthroid.
Yep.
It's interesting how the body reacts.
Yes, I have experience in that respect. That's for sure. Tried it all.
Okay, I'm quickly going to go through this. The Russians use these peptides that they formulated. By the way, back in the early days in the 70s, the first peptide that they developed was the thymus peptide, and the second one was the pineal gland peptide. They now have 23 of what we call the natural peptides, all of them sourced from 12-month-old calves. So what they do is they take a 12-month calf, they then, unfortunately, slaughter the animal, but very carefully take all of the organs, and they then filter and process the organs each individually and create these peptides from a specific organ. And so they take, they have a brain peptide, for instance, that came from the brain of that calf. They have a retina peptide from the retina of the calf, a pancreas, mm-hmm, a liver, a kidney, et cetera, et cetera. And there are 23 of these, what we call natural peptides. We're only using those in the clinical studies because in Russia and accepted in the U.S., these peptides are considered to be food supplements because, yes, they're natural based. Okay, and so we don't have any difficulty bringing them into the United States. Customs is familiar with them and so forth. There's an additional 30-some-odd synthetic peptides or peptides, even the natural ones, that are injectable, lingual, sublingual, etc., but we only use the natural peptides. So let's look at retina issues. In the United States, unfortunately, and pretty much the rest of the world, if a person has a serious retina disease like retinitis pigmentosa, macular degeneration, there's very little that can be done. The most that can be done typically is to slow the progression a little bit, but
yes,
there's no effective treatment. Okay. In Russia, they use the vision peptides as follows. This is diabetic retinoplasty, and I'm not going to go through each one. Where you see the green on the right, that's the after treatment. On the left is the before treatment. Where you see green, that means they have some vision there, but where you see the yellow, the red, and the black, that's impaired vision, and particularly when you get to the stage of red and black, that means basically no vision there. So this was a patient treated with peptides for a couple of years. And at the end of the couple of years with another scan, we have a tremendous increase in their vision potential at this point based on the amount of green you see here.
That's amazing.
So, yes, it is, truly. Here's retinitis pigmentosa. You look at the amount of black on the left compared to the right after treatment. Here's macular degeneration. If you see on the left, there's a lot of yellow and a fair amount of black. Over on the right, I would say there's a decrease of at least 60-70% of that. And same thing with glaucoma, tremendous increase after post-treatment.
And they've actually tried this one on pets as well. It works for dogs. Dogs,
yeah,
the glaucoma.
Yeah, absolutely. All the peptides can be used for animals. I have several veterinarians who are in the clinical studies who use them for themselves, of course, but I know that because they've talked to me about it, they use them on their animals. Okay, let's get to the methylation study.
Okay.
First, let's understand a little bit about methylation.
Yes.
Incredibly complex. There are entire medical books written about methylation, okay? Methylation is sort of, you might call it I call it a chemical factory, okay? It's the chemical factory that makes everything work in the body, basically. Here they talk a little bit about, the various eye health, fat metabolism, liver health, and so forth. But it's basically everything is impacted by methylation. And it boils down to, it's a chemical process that goes on from the moment of conception throughout a person's life. This is sort of what it looks like, okay? Interesting put together of several methylated, combinations, carbon combinations and so forth. I just thought it was kind of interesting to see it in a complex. Here's a bit of a definition that will help. And I'm not going to read the whole thing. It's amazing that methylation occurs several billion times a second in our bodies. That is this chemical processing that goes on. Down at the bottom, they say ATP energy. If the cell can't produce ATP, then there's not going to be adequate energy in the body, much like a car running out of gas. So you can think of methylation as sort of like the gas in a vehicle, but it's actually all the chemicals. Here's a little more scientific explanation of why methylation becomes problematic. It is vital for proper methylation throughout life. Okay, it causes cell differentiation, it produces energy, it's the chemical factory. What happens though is that with time, and I'll come to that in a moment, another way to think of methylation, for those who have seen the telomere presentation, I talked about telomeres are very much like tread on the tires, okay? And as you drive on those set of tires, then the tread wears down. That's exactly what happens with telomeres as you have cell replication. When you get to a point where the tire has worn down quite a bit, it becomes unsafe in order to continue driving it. There might be a blowout. It may not grip the road under icy conditions as well and so forth. Well, the same thing is true with telomeres. If telomeres get short enough, we know from many, many, I mean literally thousands of clinical studies that when you have shorter telomeres, there's less functionality. In other words, the cell can't replicate as quickly, which is important, mm-hmm. and B, it can't replicate perfectly. And so that's where people start to become vulnerable, old age, vulnerability to diseases, frailty, Alzheimer's, and all of those kinds of things. So methylation kind of works in the same way, in that the way I explain it to non-physicians is that methylation is like, say you have you've got a big factory, or let's say you've got a home with a large amount of yardage, and it's sort of in a marginal crime area, and so you have it well lit at night, and you have a bunch of switches that automatically will light it up as the sun sets, then the whole yard or the chemical factory outside will light up, and then as the sun comes up in the morning, the auto system turns off that system and the lights go down. Well, methylation, as we age, is sort of the same way, in that what happens with the chemical factory or the home is that at some point, because the system wears out or whatever, it malfunctions. And so at night, when the lights are supposed to come on, they don't. Mm. And in the morning, when the lights are supposed to go off, they don't. Okay, in other words, it's malfunctioning. Well, that's the same thing that happens with human beings, in that this methylation system, this chemical process that has to do with what we call CPG islands and so forth, this same process runs fine until it doesn't. And what was discovered at UCLA, and I'll talk about Dr. Horvath in a moment, okay. What was discovered at UCLA and other places, it's been known for a long time that as we age, the chemical system or the methylation system or the chemical factory starts putting out incorrect chemicals, I guess is the way you could say it. And what in the genetic world, what we say is that the methylation that is supportive of healthy aging shuts down, and instead other methylation, I call it toxic methylation, starts up, and it turns off genes that support aging, and it starts to turn on genes that are destructive to aging. Mm. Okay, so it creates this opposite pattern of what you want to have happen. Some scientists say that this is programmed into the human body because once you have reproduced, many scientists basically say the functionality of the human being is pretty much used up at that point. What we're supposed to do is reproduce to create, another generation. And so they theorize that this is a natural substance, a process, that it is not a breakdown in the system, that it's actually programmed into basically, the end of life and the next generation comes along. So Dr. Horvath, Stephen Horvath at UCLA, the same place I went to law school, he and a group of some 60 scientists have studied this whole process for years. And what they discovered was that they could fairly accurately create a method of determining the biological age. I'm oversimplifying it, Sandy.
Yeah, okay. That's okay.
They could create a methodology to basically determine the biological age of all the major organs in the human body. Okay. So the telomere thing that we were looking at was just looking at the end caps on telomeres.
Right.
Dr. Horvath's team is looking at all the major organs in the body and attempting to determine what is their biological age. This is sort of a metaphor for it. In other words, we're looking at the clocks or the biological age of all these systems and organs to come up with a composite biological age based on these, on measuring what we call methylation levels. Okay, and it turns out it's pretty accurate. What they did was part of the work that they did was they took stored blood, that is, people who had blood tests 20 or more years earlier and who had died.
Okay.
So the scientists had this stored blood, basically just labs that were done by people like going to LabCorp or Quest or so forth. They had access to that stored blood. It was frozen. And they knew about the various diseases that that person had experienced. They knew their date of death. And what they did was, using the formulas or the logarithms that they had created, they went back and they were able to figure out basically how long, we'll call it a biological age. They were able to figure out the biological age on average of the human being by looking at basically all their major organs, okay, and come up with a number. And we'll go to that in just a moment. And what their logarithms and the work that they had done scientifically was so accurate that they blinded the death data, ran their logarithms on the measurements that they had figured out how to take, and they could predict a person's death within 2 years.
Holy smokes. Okay. So you're telling me they took old blood samples of these individuals.
Mm-hmm.
Is that right? So it was
yes.
Old, it was frozen, and then these people had since died? Amazing. How do they do that?
Well, the process isn't so amazing. It's actually fairly simple, the process. But the amazing part is that they have been able to figure out, basically, it's very complicated, this part of it, looking on the degree of methylation and what genes are not expressing because of the interference of the methylation, the toxic aspect of it, okay? Looking at all of that, they can assign a biological age to this person. That is, they can say this person is 63, but looking at all of this, their average biological age is 65, okay? They were also able to use it to basically confirm a person's close to their chronological age. So, for instance, it has many uses outside of the world of science. In Germany, the police departments are now using it. Let's say they're on a crime scene. There's a bit of blood, but the suspect is long gone. Okay, all they have is a little bit of blood that they know belongs to a suspect.
Right.
They're able to take that bit of blood, run it through Dr. Horvath's, technology and so forth, and they can predict within about 2 years how old this person is. So instead of having no information at all, they'll have the blood type, of course, as well, but instead of having no information about a suspect, they can say this is a male between the ages of 24 and 26. That's who we're going to be looking for. That's mm-hmm. how accurate it is.
Now, is Dr. Horvath's, because I know there's a few different ways to measure methylation, but Dr. Horvath's is known as a very accurate way, correct? Like, there's a few out there.
Yes, there are some what we would call methylation clocks or epigenetic clocks that I'll come to in a moment.
Okay.
There's a half a dozen of them.
Yeah.
And like anything else in science, they build on each other. And Dr. Horvath's is, I think, generally accepted that his is the most accurate at the moment. And, he built on earlier work that was done.
Right.
Okay, so now we get to epigenetics. And we call it the epigenetic Horvath clock, or just the Horvath clock. It's based on epigenetics. And what epigenetics is, you can see from the slide, people used to think that genetics basically drove pretty much everything that happened to human beings in terms of their longevity, their health, and so forth. Years ago, I think 30 years ago, when I was really new in this field, they were talking about it being like 50% of what was going to happen to a person. If you have genetic markers for, say, heart disease or Alzheimer's and so forth, those genes, they felt at the time, that would weigh 50% in terms of the likelihood of a person coming down with those situations. Mm-hmm. Today, it's more in the range of 10 to 15%. It has really advanced a lot. And what has grown in place of it is what we call epigenetics. And epigenetics is basically all the things that happen to us during our lifetime. The toxicities that we're exposed to, literally the stress levels when we were young and that we have occurred over life, the environment, literally the food that we put into our bodies, how physically active, how much we exercise, all of those are called epigenetic considerations. And as the genetic portion of our future has dropped in terms of significance, it's still there and it's still significant, epigenetics has grown as instead.
Right. Now, I was going to ask too, but there's some genetics that is just inevitable. Like,
yes, certain
sometimes we're just born, even our eye color and our, right? Like, there's some things that are just inevitable. Whereas you're saying epigenetics itself is now really changing this entire field, meaning that it's come up here more. We know a lot more of how certain actions can affect whether we turn these genes on or off, is what you're
Precisely.
Saying.
Yeah. 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 The expression that's used is whether or not the gene expresses.
Right. Okay? Right.
Yeah. Yeah. And what they're finding is that epigenetics, I would say epigenetics, in the mind of most scientists and certainly me, epigenetics is more important than genetics, okay? That is, you can basically keep a genetic problematic situation from expressing, probably, if your epigenetic profile is excellent, okay? On the other hand, if your epigenetic profile, high stress, bad food, bad environment, etc., then that genetic pattern probably is going to express, or has at least a higher possibility of expressing.
I totally believe that.
Okay, so this is what's fascinating now, and this is where I come into this. What Dr. Horvath found, and when I say Dr. Horvath, we're talking about a team of about 60 scientists working for more than 5 years together. What they found was that if your epigenetic age, okay, is 8 years or more over or faster than your calendar age, what their research determined was that you have just doubled your risk of dying, okay? On the other hand, if your epigenetic age is 7 years less than your chronological or calendar age, you're protected because you have half the risk of death. Okay, and translate that into people who have we're seeing that people who have a epigenetic age, and we're going to look at some slides data here in a moment, people who have an epigenetic age older than their calendar age have led stressful lives, have had a variety of diseases, a variety of unfortunate events in their life typically that drives it. That's the epigenetics that we were talking about before. And it drives that epigenetic age to be older than your calendar age. And it's the epigenetic age that really determines mortality in many ways, okay, much more so than the calendar age. And the reverse is true. A person who has not had all of those negative kinds of conditions, epigenetic conditions, is aging slower, basically, than their calendar age. Now, mm-hmm. Let's see what that all comes down to.
Okay.
Oh, this is cancer, to show you the effect. Epigenetic cancer, Rick. As it shows here, this is a clinical study from Yahava. For every 1 year increase in the difference between the chronological and the epigenetic age, a 6% increase risk of developing cancer within 3 years. And we go back to the thousands of blood analysis that were done, that 20-year, you know, stored blood and so on. This, the science is based on a lot of this, came out of that, okay? And if you have, let's see here, 6% increased risk of 3 years and a 17% increased risk of dying of cancer in the next 5 years.
That's crazy.
Yeah, it is. And it gets crazier, Sandy, as you'll see in a moment. Okay, so I created a graphic chart to kind of represent this. This shows increased mortality risk. So on the x-axis over here on the left, what we have is the number of years older than your calendar age, okay? Mm-hmm. And it goes up, you know, 2, 4, 6, 8, 10 years. On the right shows the increased mortality risk as you have this disparity between your calendar and the epigenetic age. So if a person, let's say, take the four there, if they are 4 years older than their calendar age, they have a 50% increased mortality risk compared to their same age peers whose calendar age and epigenetic age is the same. And we're going to see this in some data here in a moment.
And that could be just from any of the diseases that are associated with this.
Diseases, what drives
turning
it is
on
all the things that we
those
just...
those genes, yeah.
Yeah, it can turn on, it can allow those genes to be expressed, that's one factor, but also just lifestyle. I mean, a person, you know, we don't know specifically, but the assumptions are, if a person, you know, basically spent their life eating in McDonald's, okay, or fast food places, they're probably going to have an epigenetic age that is above their calendar age, okay? If a person has lived in a very toxic environment, you know, next to a chemical plant or a nuclear power plant maybe, or mm-hmm. just, you know, in a toxic area, they're probably, based on the data, because, you know, this is fairly new, so there's not a lot of data at this point, they're probably going to have an accelerated epigenetic age. On the other hand, the same kind of thing on the x-axis over here, the number of years below your calendar age shows a decreased mortality risk. So we take that same four here in the middle. If a person is 4 years below their calendar age, they have a reduced risk of 28% compared to their same age peers. Now, I'm showing this as a linear kind of relationship. It's not. Okay, but this gives you sort of the idea. It's not quite as straightforward and exact as this by any means at all. So let's look at a couple more things, and then we're going to get to my data. This is Stephen Horvath. He says it's great we can measure your age and you're 5 years older. At this point, he says, I don't see a clear utility of that information because we don't have a pill or an intervention. And that is the status quo at the moment, is Stephen Horvath acknowledges it's, you know, we can measure it, but kind of shrugs his shoulders and says, but so what? Because we can't do anything about it. I'm going to prove him wrong.
I was just going to say, there's lots.
Yeah,
there's lots.
Here we go.
Yeah.
The Russians published in 2015, they were ahead in this area, like they are with telomeres. They understood all of this way, way back. And they published here, you know, a published study with regard to, basically, you can translate that into simple language. You can affect the epigenetic age with peptides. That's really what it translates as epigenetic regulation of gene expression. It's a fancy word for saying you can use peptides to affect your epigenetic age. So I started talking to Professor Cavinson years ago, 4 or 5 years ago, first the telomere study. And then once we got approval for the telomere study and we were several years into it, about 2 years ago, a little over 2 years ago, COVID kind of slowed it down for us. But 2 years ago, he approved a methylation study. And the goal of this is to determine if we can use the peptide bioregulators that we talked about it in the first video with regard to lengthening telomeres, can we also change people's epigenetic age? In other words, can we take a person who has an older epigenetic age than their calendar and can we reverse that? Can we make them younger epigenetically and modify the epigenetic damage that maybe has been happening, you know, over the years?
Mm-hmm.
So the baseline before we started the study, as we were getting ready, I had people who had been in the telomere study for several years at that point, including myself. So what we did, there's two labs in the U.S. that test for DNA methylation age, you might say. And so we used one of the labs, and we tested 9 subjects who had been on the peptides, okay, for at least 2 years or more. Some of them, like myself, had been on them for like 4 years at this point. Mm-hmm. And their DNA age came back 5.42 years less than their chronological. Zero is chronological up here, okay? Yeah. So this group of 9 people who had been on peptides came back with almost a five and a half year less epigenetic age than their chronological age, okay? In other words, they had decreased risk, literally, of death at this point. If there were 5 years less, their decrease would be about 40-some-odd percent compared to their peers. And we're going to look at that chart again. Then at the same time, I took 15 people who had not been on any peptides, who were being recruited into this new study, and we tested their baseline average DNA age or epigenetic age. They came back on the average 2 years older than their chronological age. Okay. This is not proof. This is not evidence. This is right. What we call proof of concept. Okay. It's a suggestion that maybe it's worth doing some further research and run a clinical study to show that peptides can have a favorable impact. If these numbers had come back, Sandy, where there was no difference between the peptide group and this, we wouldn't be having this conversation today. Exactly. Because we wouldn't have gone forward.
Yeah.
Okay, now I just clicked ahead a little bit. Let me get back. Okay, so with this proof of concept that peptides can intervene in the epigenetic age, we then started the study. And let's see. This is me. This is my baseline test. I showed you my baseline tests in the telomeres. Yes. And, of course, we always start with the scientist experimenting on himself.
Yeah.
So I was 72 when we, 2 years ago, when we did my baseline. I had been on the peptides for 4-some-odd years at that point. My DNA age, as we call it, or is it what this lab calls it, came back at 64. That's 8 years less than my chronological, okay? So what does that mean in terms of risk profile? I'm off the charts, okay? At 7 years, I have a 50% reduced mortality risk compared to my peers. And Dr. Horvath's research didn't go beyond 7 years, so we don't know at 8 years. But basically, my mortality risk is about half of that of a 74-year-old male in this country.
That's amazing. Now let's go.
I'm sorry?
I said that's amazing.
Yeah. Yeah, it is. But it's real science. I mean, this is not theoretical. This is real stuff. So this is the opposite extreme. This is a friend of mine. He's a London health professional. His baseline, he was 57 when we did the baseline. He'd not been on peptides, and he came back at 72. That's 15 years older than his calendar age.
Right.
Let's go to the graph. He's off the graph. Wow. Okay. At 8 years, he has a 100%, in other words, his increased mortality risk is double that of a person standing next to him of the same chronological age. Yeah. But his was 15 years. So he's got an almost 200% increased risk of death compared to a same age peer. He was not pleased.
No, I guess not.
And he's doing something about it. He's in the study.
Oh, that's good. That's good.
Okay, so let's look at some data. Now, this data is just now coming in. COVID really set us back quite a bit for a lot of reasons. We're just now getting the secondary tests in. And what we're discovering is that it's takes longer to reverse DNA age than it does telomere age. And I think I know the reason why. I think the reason why is that there are 78 human organs and systems, and the DNA age formula, the Horvus technology, is basically based on methylation changes, is basically gauging a biological age of most of those major organs. So there's a lot more that has to happen when you've got 78 organs than when you're just dealing with, and I shouldn't say just, I mean, telomeres are incredibly important, but when you're dealing with the same issue, that is telomere length on the end of chromosomes. So this is a person whose chronological age and DNA age was 53, okay, the same. And that means that she has the normal, that's why her percentile is about 45%. She has basically the normal mortality risk of a female, you know, roughly her age, just slightly less than others. Okay, now, let's go a year and a half, 18 months later, the same person. We put her on the peptide program. She's now 54 instead of 53, and her DNA age now has dropped to 52. So she's now 3 years younger than her chronological age, DNA-wise. And we go to Horvath's information. At 3 years less, she's now 21% less mortality risk than she was 18 months earlier. So instead of being at the same mortality risk, you know, a normal human being at her age and so forth, she now has an improved mortality risk of less, you know, a decreased mortality risk of 21%. So she's got an improvement compared to her peers.
Yeah, and okay. You can see from these too that the needle definitely moves a lot slower with this
yes.
study. You know, whereas
yes.
in the other study that we were talking about, you might see like 18 years, right, with the telomere study. I know that on some examples it was quite significant, whereas this is just a couple years, right?
Yes, but okay, and this is very important, okay? You can't compare the two at all.
Okay.
And people fall into this trap. They say to me, well, Bill, you know, my telomere, you know, I'm 15 years younger telomere-wise, and it only took 12 months. Or
right.
That would be, okay. On the other hand, we only got a two-year improvement in my DNA. Well, we're measuring different things, and what they have to understand is We go to these charts. What we're talking about here, that one. If a person is 2 years older, let's look at the number two.
Yeah.
If they're 2 years older than their calendar age, they have a 25% increased risk of death. We're moving that needle from 25% increased risk to 28% less risk.
Yes.
I mean, that is incredible. That is, I won't say it's more important than telomere, because it's sort of like saying the tires are more important than the engine. You know, you need them both.
Yes.
But, yeah, people have that same kind of reaction. Well, Bill, I'm not so impressed that I only changed by 2 years. It isn't the years that's important. It's the mortality risk factor.
Yeah. It's the percentage.
And if someone,
yes.
Yeah, and Sandy, if someone came to you and said, you know, you take these, you intervene with this protocol of peptides for, say, 18 months or 2 years, and it will change your mortality risk, it will decrease your mortality risk by 28%. I mean, there ain't nothing out there in the world that comes close to that.
Exactly.
Okay, so let's go on. Okay, that was the lady with the same. And what's interesting about this is we call it the gap, G-A-P. People get concerned because, well, maybe their DNA age hasn't changed too much, maybe by 1 year, but they're 2 years older. And they'll say, well, but I was 52 2 years ago DNA-wise, and I'm only 51 now. That's not much of a change. Yeah. But you're 2 years older,
right?
And what Horvath found was it didn't matter what age, it's the gap that counts. It's the number of years different between your DNA age and your chronological that counts. And so, if an 85-year-old person has a gap of 2 years, or a 32-year-old person has a gap of 2 years, they have the same risk of mortality. Okay. Now, the 32-year-old will live longer, okay, but their mortality risk all through life is going to be at least that 32 and will probably increase over the years.
Yes.
So it isn't that we're going to reduce the DNA age so much. What we're going to do is create that gap. And our goal in these studies is get everybody to have a DNA age at least 5 and preferably 7 years less than their calendar age, because at that point, they're in the sweet spot. They're in that 50% or 40% reduced risk. Okay. Okay, this is another lab test. This is also a physician, July of 19. He was one of the earliest coming in. And his chronological age was 53. His DNA age was 55, 2 years older than his chronological. So based on that, he's got about a 25% increased mortality risk at this point, okay? And what we are seeing is that, because the study continues on, what I'm seeing is that if we can, for instance, hold the DNA age constant, even though another year goes by, or 2 years, what we do is we pick up decreased mortality risk, because if we go back to, well, I'll come back to that in a moment. It's going to get confusing. Okay. So we put him on the peptide program. Okay. And about 2 years later, 18 months later, he is now 55 chronologically, but his DNA age has dropped to 51. Okay. So now he's 4 years younger, or I shouldn't say it. That's not a right, proper terminology. He has 4 years less mortality risk,
right.
Okay? And what that shows on our chart here is at 4 years, well, let me actually go back. When he was two years over his chronological age, he had an increased mortality risk of 25%.
Right.
Okay? He's vulnerable at that point. So he goes on the peptide program. We now have a 4 year gap between the two. And notice that over here, terms of the population, it's hard to see, but at his baseline, he's in the 16th percentile compared to his same age peers, okay? And over here, he's moved up to the 86th percentile. I mean, huge increase compared to his peers. And the most important thing is being 4 years less than his chronological. We come over here, he's got a 28% decreased mortality risk. So instead of a 25% increased mortality risk through his lifetime,
yeah,
he's more protected. He's got a 28% decreased. So when Dr. Horvath, you know, I have great respect for him. He's a brilliant individual. Born in Germany and so forth, been here in the United States a long time. Wonderful man. He's just not aware, just like the telomere scientific community pretty much around the world aren't aware, that there are interventions that the Russians have figured out that can change these numbers, can change and re-lengthen telomeres, can change the DNA mortality risk. Okay, so now that's pretty much the DNA methylation. Here's the last piece of this. There are really three studies. The telomere study, mm-hmm, but it's a confirmation study. I already know what the outcome of that's going to be. I knew on day one because the Russians had already done that, you know, years ago. The DNA methylation study, they'd never done the study as such. They had a lot of theory and so forth. It's the first study that I'm aware of that actually has been able to move the needle. So that is a true clinical study, okay? The third is a bunch of clinical studies. I know the outcome because they were done also a long time ago. And this is what we call organ regeneration. So before I jump to that, Smithsonian Magazine just printed an article based on a clinical study where they're indicating that the human potential lifespan could be 150 years.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Yeah. And we're going to come back to this in a moment.
Okay.
Okay. Now, So we call it the peptide longevity program. It's the umbrella program for these clinical studies. And the goal is enhance lifespan and reduce mortality using the peptide bioresin. So here's the scientific data, because it's always the data.
Mm-hmm.
So before I get to, quite to the data, this is the aging expectation that we talked about earlier. Okay. This is the aging expectation that Dr. Cavinson and I have and expect to be able to share with as many people as we can. Here is the published clinical study for the data I'm going to show you in a few moments. It was published in 2002. And so the Russians have known for that long how to extend life by reducing mortality. And the DNA methylation and the peptides basically operate on all of these organs that you see here, as well as many others. Okay, as I said earlier, there's 78 of them. What the program does is it goes in at the cellular level using these peptides, and it regenerates at the cellular level, then the tissue, then the entire organ, all of these major organs. And so at the end of a certain period of time that we're going to talk about in a moment, a person basically walks out with, I don't know if the word is remodeled or I can't think of the word. If you took your car in and said, go in and change out everything that needs to be changed out so that it's a brand new running, you know, vehicle and so forth.
Refurbished.
That's a good word.
Yeah.
Yeah. I love that. Thank you, Sandy. Yeah. What you have here is, in a sense, not totally, because, you know, we can't change the outward appearance of the person and so forth, but we can refurbish, okay? We can refurbish all of their important organs.
Yes.
Now, let's see. Lawrence is saying we can do this. Let's look at the data. Okay, here comes the proof. The attorney part of me says, yeah, okay, show me the evidence.
Yes.
Okay. Here's the evidence. I mentioned this in the telomere study just briefly, I think I did. But this is too important to not revisit. What the Russians did was they did a whole bunch of studies. These are just a couple of them. They took a group of people called elderly people. The age bracket was 60 to 74 years of age. And they had a control group, which was the non-peptide group, people just taking what they call polyvitamins, you know, no peptides here, okay? And let's just skip down. They did a review data collection at 8 years, but let's go down to the 12-year study altogether, okay? It just continued on. In that period of time, what they were looking at, the end point was mortality, okay? In other words, how many people died, okay? And in this study of 60 to 74-year-old people over 12 years, 44% of these people died. As I think I said earlier in the other podcast, that may seem high, but these are Russians and Ukrainian people, and they don't have the best lifestyle, and they actually have less longevity than most of the rest of the world, although the Americans are catching up to them, unfortunately. Do you know that in the last 2 years, we've had a decrease in the average length of life of the typical American, life expectancy? It's decreased for the first time in our history.
Really?
And not just because of COVID. It got accelerated a little bit by COVID, but it was already in that direction before COVID. Anyway, yeah, it has to do with diabetes and obesity and those things.
Mm-hmm.
So 44% of these people die. Here's the peptide group with one single peptide, okay, just one peptide, the pineal gland peptide. And remember, we have 23 now, okay?
Yes.
The mortality rate was dropped in half over that 12 years. In other words, people on the peptides had half the death rate or mortality rate than the people not on a peptide. Cut it in half. The way that this happened was through organ regeneration, particularly, you know, with the pineal, because it's like the master gland, you know, peptide and so forth. So then in another study, they had an older group. As I said to you recently, the Russians are not considered great diplomats. They call these people old people. Okay.
You're almost there. You're almost there, aren't you?
Thanks for the reminder. Yes.
You don't look it.
No.
You don't look it. You don't act it. So look at you. I mean, you would never think that. So.
Okay, let's get back to this. Oh, come on. Here, wait a minute. I'll fix it up here. Okay. Okay. So me and my fellow old people, in 2 months I'll be 75, yeah. Okay. So in that group of people, it was a 6-year study, of course, because, you know, the age of the people and so forth. So in the control group here, okay, almost 82% of these people died, 81.8.
Yeah.
Okay. Again, using just the pineal peptide, okay, it dropped it to 46%, 45.8%. I mean, doggone. Oh, I got to stop holding it down. Okay. I get overly excited about this stuff.
Yes.
Because it applies to me as well. And all my loved ones and Peanut, our little puggle dog, and so forth on peptides. Peanut, see? The peptide dog.
There you go.
Okay. So 45% on the one peptide reduction from 82. Then they had added for the 6 years, they added a second peptide, and that's the thymus or immune system peptide. They dropped those people that were taking the two peptides, their mortality rate dropped to 33%. So from 82% to 33% in this old people category, that was the incredible reduction in mortality. And the reason that it happened was they got telomere lengthening. They also, without knowing it at the time, got DNA methylation modification. But most importantly, they got organ regeneration. That's what the peptides were doing, just with those two peptides. So the exciting thing about it is that today we have 23 of these peptides. And in the clinical studies, we're using most of those for most people. I would say the average person is probably using, over a course of a year, they're using at least 19 or 20 of the various peptides, because there's peptides, you know, for the heart, for the liver, kidney, pancreas, the retina, muscles, cartilage renewal, and so forth. Now, here's the really amazing part of this. Let's go back up here. In this group, oh, there it is. Okay. In this group here, the elderly people, that study went on for 12 years. They only used the peptides for the first 3 years.
And so it can, they weren't on a maintenance after the 3 years?
No maintenance. They regenerated in 3 years' time.
Wow.
They regenerated the important systems, organs, and so forth. Then there were no peptides given for the next 9 years at all.
That's unreal.
Isn't it? Yeah.
That is.
No maintenance.
Okay, so basically these peptides help them to tap into their own biological reserve.
Yes, it did. Absolutely. Good wording. Yes, yeah.
That's amazing.
Yeah, yeah. What was the word you I was using remodeling.
Refurbished.
You said,
refurbished.
Okay. So you go refurbish your car. You don't have to refurbish it every year.
True.
You do some maintenance.
Yes. If you get a new MacBook, you can get a refurbished MacBook and it'll last you quite a while, right?
That's right. That's right. The same theory here. So they only use the peptides. They were curious. They wanted to know, if they use the peptides at the beginning, what would happen in this case 9 years later for the group in the 12-year group down here? So 3 years on and just on two peptides, 9 years off, and then they did the evaluation of how many people died, and they got these numbers.
Wow. Okay?
And on the older group, the 75 to 89 here, they use the peptides for the first 2 years only.
Wow, that's pretty good. So the warranty lasts pretty long.
It lasts a long time, yes.
Yeah,
yeah, exactly.
I like it.
And so the people that are in the clinical study, we ask them, you know, it's not mandatory, but we ask them voluntarily if they will commit to staying in 3 years. And then it's up to them. If they want to do some kind of minor maintenance after that, that's fine. We'll continue to provide them with the peptides. But they could walk away at that point, and they ought to be able to get a bunch of years. And we don't know, because the Russians didn't continue stop it for 9 years and then start again.
Yes.
So we don't know how long the warranty is, you might say.
Yes, Yeah. When does that expire? That's still
we don't know exactly. No, but
right?
Now let me go to something that has almost nothing to do directly with this. Okay.
Okay.
This is a guy by the name of Irv Gordon. Okay. He drove this Volvo. I think it was a 1966 Volvo. You may have heard about him. He has the Guinness World Record for driving the same car the largest number of miles. 3.2 million miles he drove this 1966 Volvo.
Okay.
And the point here is he maintained it meticulously.
Ah.
But take a look at him, though.
Hmm.
Yeah. He's not looking so maintained, is he? I think he spent too much time driving his Volvo around because he died last year at age 77.
Hmm.
Yeah. Yeah, the message is maintain yourself, okay? So we're coming to the end of this. We talked about this before, the bridge concept. And what we're talking about here is that there are things like these peptide bioregulators are been around for a long time in Russia, but they're being introduced through these clinical studies here in America. That's just one of many interventions. I think for my own journey, the reason I'm involved with them is that they have, for me, a large amount of leverage. In other words, for what I have to do, take some, you know, capsules and so forth, do some testing every year to get the kind of results that we're seeing here on the data. It's the primary thing that I would do to get longevity and health span. But there are other things. You know, I'm also doing stem cells and just a half a dozen things besides the telomeres and the peptides and so forth. The point is this, is that there are things that you can do now, of which many I'm doing, okay? There are things on the drawing board that are available soon. The Israelis 18 months ago came out, a company came out with clinical data showing that they had some substances taken in pill form that in 3 weeks' time basically stopped every form of cancer that they were able to test.
Really?
Yeah. It won't make it to America forever, but it will probably be available through their FDA equivalent in another 2 years, and so people will fly to Israel, spend 3 weeks taking these substances, basically, and stop the cancer and reverse it. Okay.
Wow.
There's too much money invested in cancer treatment in America for them to allow that to occur over here, unfortunately. But the point is this, is that there are amazing things that are on the drawing boards that I talk to other scientists almost weekly about that are you know, on the cusp of becoming available. Diabetes is going to be controllable here very soon. Heart disease, same thing. All the major diseases, cancer will be in other countries, will be both controlled and reversed in other countries very soon. But you've got to stay healthy for the next 10 years in order to take advantage of these things. If you can stay healthy and get to the other end of this bridge, you will have the benefit of all of the technology that's being developed right now and some of which is available, like the peptide bioregulators. So with that, I think I've given you all the information I can with regard to the DNA methylation study and the organ regeneration study.
I love this stuff. I actually, you know, I find this side of it, the two studies are both very, very important, but the methylation side of it, I find a lot more exciting. It's a lot more interesting to me personally, let's just say, but I understand why both are very important. Now, here's a question for you. These individuals who are in the clinical study, what are their lifestyle habits, or does that not even apply?
Oh, no, it applies. I can't measure the impact on these biomarkers that we're looking at, you know, the telomeres, and because I can't do an exhaustive profile of each person's lifestyle and compare them to others in the study.
Right.
These are basically, they're healthy people because they're, most of them now are health professionals. We only admit health professionals into the clinical studies.
Right.
with a few exceptions. If they have any serious disease, we will not. If they have active cancer, we will not admit them into the clinical study. Not because we think that the peptides would be harmful. They wouldn't. In fact, they would be helpful.
Yes.
But the problem is, if the cancer gets worse and they die, then the conventional physicians are going to look for a scapegoat. Mm-hmm. Oh, you're on these pills from Russia? Oh, my goodness.
Oh, yeah, you don't want that. No.
Yeah, right. So, but to answer your question, I can't measure, but the people that I deal with on a daily basis are really healthy, but they were healthy at least the last 2 years. You know, as I said to you before, 5 years ago when I was starting the telomere study, if you had a pulse, I was asking you to join the study,
right. Okay?
Now, though, because we're restricted to health professionals, and the health professionals are not your overweight conventional physician who is telling you what to do but doesn't do it themselves.
Right.
Okay, these are alternative, holistic people who are really targeting health. They're healthy, and we do... with a number of the physicians, they use the peptides for their patients, and I get feedback. I see their labs. I get the feedbacks from the doctors. A person has a kidney problem. 6 months later, the kidney problem is resolved. And I need to kind of stay away from that whole thing. But
yeah, no, I understand. This is all just information just from the clinical study. So there's no medical advice given here. It is simply information being passed on.
Yes.
But then, you know, even if you go back to the studies, let's say that Russia did on, you talked about it, is it MPROM, the gas employees?
Gazprom.
Gazprom, yeah. That's it. You know, it's not like they were saying, okay, are you a smoker? Are you not a smoker? Are you, right? Like everybody saw that needle move who were on the peptides, but maybe lifestyle comes into play with how well they're going to work depending on what you're doing, correct?
Yeah, this is not a cure-all by any means at all. What this does is it makes you, the peptides will make you much healthier. And so the Gazprom studies that we looked at in the telomere section, what they had was about a 2.6 and 2.8 reduction in sickness based on people showing up for work, in other words, the number of days that people were missing work. So they had a control group, not on the peptides, then they had a control group or a peptide group, and what they figured out, or what the data showed, was that there was a 2.7 times reduction in missed days by the due to respiratory diseases based on using the peptides.
Right.
And I think overall sickness was 2.8 or 2.9 times reduced. So basically it's protecting people. What it's really doing, Sandy, is it's taking those organs, particularly the thymus and the pineal gland, and regenerating them such that they become much more effective at warding off disease.
Right. Okay, I have a couple of other questions, and then we've already gone to over an hour. I get the feeling that stress seems to be a pretty huge factor. So, you know, not everyone, and I always like to make this applicable to anybody, not everyone can go into a clinical study. Not everyone can take peptides. However, it seems that stress seems to be the big factor which can really affect your overall health and wellness. Would you agree with that?
Sort of. The reason I say sort of, I think there's two things that it would be hard to tease out which is more impactful. And the two things are stress and diet.
Okay.
Yeah.
I like it.
Yeah, we know, as I mentioned in the telomere study, the studies that were done by Elizabeth Blackburn out of UC San Francisco, who one of the recipients of the Nobel Prize in 2009, that pregnant women who had a stressful pregnancy give birth to newborns with significantly shorter telomeres to go through life with.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, that's how impactful it is.
Unbelievable. And then individuals that would, say, go on, you know, like peptides or whatever, if, like, I'm just trying to think, even the individuals who are in your clinical studies, they technically really wouldn't need to take supplements, right? Because if they're doing both studies and they're doing all of the protocols, then why would they need to take other supplements? Does that make sense?
Yeah, it makes sense, but here's the reason why they probably would want to continue with many of their supplements.
All right.
If our foods were real food, you know, like we had, like our grandparents had, okay, not the, you know, pesticides and the glyphosate and the meats that are done, you know, in these factories and all that, and the hormones and so forth, then I would say, yeah, sure. You know, they can get their vitamins that they need, the necessary ones, basically from food. Because that's not the case, certainly here in the U.S., I would say, yes, I still take a number of what we call nutraceuticals.
Okay.
Yes.
All right. Yep. That's great advice. Is there anything else that you'd like to add, Dr. Lawrence?
I think people should not get the idea that a peptide protocol or program is all they need to do. They need to do all the things that reasonable people, that you do, that I do. We touched on this, I think, in our first podcast. Mm-hmm. They need to exercise. You know, they need to avoid, you know, as far as I'm concerned, conventional doctors. And let me clarify that. It's not that I'm down on conventional doctors. The poor doctors, every doctor I've ever known really means well for his or her patients. They really, really do. But the lawyer side of me knows that they are in a very restrictive box called conventional medical standard of care. Okay. And they are aware of things outside of that conventional standard of care that would be helpful for their patients. But because the medical world and medical associations haven't put their stamp of approval on it, they can't use it. Mm-hmm. So I feel for them. But unfortunately, because of the because of the straitjacket that they're in a sense, I can't advise any person, other than in maybe the orthopedic field, okay? I can't advise any person to go to a conventional doctor for anything. They need to seek out an alternative, holistic, and integrative, whatever the term of the day is, because they don't have the straitjacket on. They have access to so many other therapeutic interventions, nutraceuticals, chelation, you name it. So my advice would be, don't rely, certainly at least get a second opinion from a non-conventional doctor. And another thing is, as far as I'm concerned, people need to tune off the conventional media, especially when it comes to anything about disease.
I'll agree with that. I've been tuning out the mass media in the last year and a bit. I'm getting pretty good at it, that's for sure.
Good. Because that will also reduce your stress level. I can tell you that the mass media has just greatly enhanced the stress level of everyone around the globe unnecessarily.
Yes, All right. Well, thank you so much once again for coming, Dr. Lawrence. I call you Dr. Bill, Dr. Lawrence. But I really appreciate your time.
It's been my pleasure.
I appreciate it. And you have a wonderful day.
Thank you very much, Andy.
Join me next week where I cover off more exciting topics. I hope to continue to engage you and excite you and show you that living in your 40s, 50s, and beyond can be exciting, balanced, and healthful. Bye for now.